Hello there, and welcome to Down to Sleep. This is my podcast of softly spoken audiobooks and bedtime stories to help you get a good night's rest. If you would prefer to listen on YouTube, then head over to youtube.com/downtosleep. There is also a Patreon where you can support me and the podcast and get two readings every week. Members of the Patreon hear everything first and get to vote on what books I read next and prioritize. So come and join me at patreon.com/downtosleep. You can find links to those and my Instagram in the info for this episode. Let's go ahead and take a nice deep breath. Let's tuck you in and let's get down to sleep. With The Secret Garden by Frances Hodgson Burnett. Good night. It was the sweetest, most mysterious-looking place anyone could imagine. The high walls which shut it in were covered with the leafless stems of climbing roses, which were so thick that they were matted together. Mary Lennox knew they were roses because she had seen a great many roses in India. All the ground was covered with grass of a wintry brown, and out of it grew clumps of bushes, which were surely rose bushes if they were alive. There were numbers of standard roses which had so spread their branches that they were like little trees. There were other trees in the garden, and one of the things which made the place look strangest and loveliest was that climbing roses had run all over them and swung down long tendrils which made light swaying curtains, and here and there they had caught at each other or at a far-reaching branch and had crept from one tree to another and made lovely bridges of themselves. There were neither leaves nor roses on them now, and Mary did not know whether they were dead or alive. But their thin grey or brown branches and sprays looked like a sort of hazy mantle spreading over everything. Walls and trees and even brown grass, where they had fallen from their fastenings and run along the ground. It was this hazy tangle from tree to tree which made it all look so mysterious. Mary had thought it must be different from other gardens which had not been left all by themselves so long, and indeed it was different from any other place she had ever seen in her life. "How still it is," she whispered. "How still." Then she waited a moment and listened at the stillness. The robin who had flown to his treetop was still as all the rest. He did not even flutter his wings. He sat without stirring and looked at Mary. "No wonder it is still," she whispered again. "I'm the first person who has spoken in here for 10 years. She moved away from the door, stepping as softly as if she were afraid of awakening someone. She was glad that there was grass under her feet and that her steps made no sounds. She walked under one of the fairy-like grey arches between the trees and looked up at the sprays and tendrils which formed them. "I wonder if they're all quite dead," she said. "Is it all a quite dead garden? I wish it wasn't." If she had been Ben Weatherstaff, she could have told whether the wood was alive by looking at it. But she could only see that there were only grey or brown sprays and branches, and none showed any signs of even a tiny leaf bud anywhere. But she was inside the wonderful garden, and she could come through the door under the ivy any time. And she felt as if she had found a world all her own. The sun was shining inside the four walls, and the high arch of blue sky over this particular piece of Misselthwaite seemed even more brilliant and soft than it was over the moor. The robin flew down from his treetop and hopped about or flew after her from one bush to another. He chirped a good deal and had a very busy air, as if he were showing her things. everything was strange and silent, and she seemed to be hundreds of miles away from anyone. But somehow, she did not feel lonely at all. All that troubled her was her wish that she knew whether all the roses were dead, or if perhaps some of them had lived, and might put out leaves and buds as the weather got warmer. She did not want it to be a quite dead garden. If it were a quite alive garden, how wonderful it would be, and what thousands of roses would grow on every side. Her skipping rope had hung over her arm when she came in, and after she walked about for a while, she thought she would skip round the whole garden, stopping when she wanted to look at things. There seemed to have been grass paths here and there, and in one or two corners there were alcoves of evergreen, with stone seats or tall moss-covered flower urns in them. As she came near the second of these alcoves, she stopped skipping. There had once been a flower bed in it, and she thought she saw something sticking out of the black earth. Some sharp little pale green points. She remembered what Ben Weatherstaff had said, and she knelt down to look at them. Yes, they are tiny growing things. They might be crocuses or snowdrops or daffodils, she whispered. She bent very close to them and sniffed the fresh scent of the damp earth. She liked it very much. Perhaps there are some other ones coming up in other places, she said. I will go all over the garden and look. She did not skip, but walked. She went slowly and kept her eyes on the ground. She looked in the old border beds and among the grass. And after she had gone round, trying to miss nothing, she had found ever so many more sharp, pale green points, and she had become quite excited again. "It isn't a quite dead garden," she cried out softly to herself. "Even if the roses are dead, there are other things alive." She did not know anything about gardening, but the grass seemed so thick in some of the places where the green points were pushing their way through that she thought they did not seem to have room enough to grow. She searched about until she found a rather sharp piece of wood and knelt down and dug and weeded out the weeds and grass until she made nice little clear places around them. "Now they look as if they could breathe," she said, after she had finished with the first ones. "I am going to do ever so many more. I'll do all I can see. If I haven't time today, I can come tomorrow." She went from place to place, and dug, and weeded, and enjoyed herself so immensely that she was led on from bed to bed, into the grass under the trees. The exercise made her so warm that she first threw her coat off, and then her hat. And without knowing it, she was smiling down onto the grass and the pale green points all the time. The robin was tremendously busy. He was very much pleased to see gardening begun on his own estate. He had often wondered at Ben Weatherstaff. Where gardening is done, all sorts of delightful things to eat are turned up with the soil. Now here was this new kind of creature, who was not half Ben's size, and yet had had the sense to come into his garden and begin at once. Mistress Mary worked in her garden until it was time to go to her midday dinner. In fact, she was rather late in remembering. And when she put on her coat and hat and picked up her skipping rope, she could not believe that she had been working 2 or 3 hours. She had been actually happy all the time, and dozens of the tiny pale green points were to be seen in cleared places, looking twice as cheerful as they had looked before, when the grass and weeds had been smothering them. "I shall come back this afternoon," she said, looking all round at her new kingdom, speaking to the trees and the rose bushes as if they heard her. Then she ran lightly across the grass, pushed open the slow old door, and slipped through it under the ivy. She had such red cheeks and such bright eyes, and ate such a dinner that Martha was delighted. 2 pieces of meat and 2 helps of rice pudding," she said. "Mother'll be pleased when I tell her what skipping rope's done for thee." In the course of her digging with her pointed stick, Mistress Mary had found herself digging up a sort of white root, rather like an onion. She had put it back in its place and patted the earth carefully down on it. And just now, she wondered if Martha could tell her what it was. "Martha," she said, "what are those white roots that look like onions?"
"They're bulbs," answered Martha. "Lots of spring flowers grow from them. The very little ones are snowdrops and crocuses, and the big ones are narcissuses and jonquils and daffodowndillies. The biggest of all is lilies and purple flags. They're nice. Dickon's got a whole lot of them planted in our bit of garden."
"Does Dickon know all about them?" asked Mary, a new idea taking possession of her.
"Our Dickon can make a flower grow out of a brick walk. Mother says he just whispers things out the ground."
"Do bulbs live a long time? Would they live years and years if no one helped them?" inquired Mary anxiously.
"They're things as helps themselves," said Martha. "That's why poor folk can afford to have 'em. If you don't trouble 'em, most of 'em'll work away underground for lifetime and spread out and have little uns. There's a place in the park woods here where there's snowdrops by thousands. They're the prettiest sight in Yorkshire when the spring comes. No one knows when they were first planted."
"I wish the spring was here now," said Mary. "I want to see all the things that grow in England."
She had finished her dinner and gone to her favourite seat on the hearthrug.
I wish I had a little spade," she said.
"Whatever does thou want a spade for?" asked Martha, laughing. "Art thou going to take to digging? I must tell mother that too."
Mary looked at the fire and pondered a little. She must be careful if she meant to keep her secret kingdom. She wasn't doing any harm, but if Mr. Craven found out about the open door, he would be fearfully angry and get a new key and lock it up forevermore. She really could not bear that.
"This is such a big, lonely place," she said slowly, as if she were turning matters over in her mind. "The house is lonely, and the park is lonely, and the gardens are lonely. So many places seem shut up. I never did many things in India, but there were more people to look at, natives and soldiers marching by, and sometimes bands playing, and my ayah told me stories. There's no one to talk to here except you and Ben Weatherstaff. And you have to do your work, and Ben Weatherstaff won't speak to me often. I thought if I had a little spade, I could dig somewhere as he does. I might make a little garden if he would give me some seeds."
Martha's face quite lighted up.
"There now," she exclaimed. "If that wasn't one of the things Mother said. She says, there's such a lot of room in that big place. Why don't they give her a bit for herself? Even if she doesn't plant nothing but parsley and radishes. She'd dig and rake away and be right down happy over it. Them's was the very words she said."
"Were they?" said Mary. "How many things she knows, doesn't she?"
"Eh?" said Martha. "It's like she says. A woman as brings up 12 children learns something besides her ABC. Children's as good as arithmetic to set you finding out things."
"How much would a spade cost? A little one?" Mary asked.
"Well," was Martha's reflective answer, At Thwaite Village, there's a shop or so, and I saw little garden sets with a spade and a rake and a fork all tied together for 2 shillings, and they were stout enough to work with, too. "I've got more than that in my purse," said Mary. "Mrs. Morrison gave me 5 shillings, and Mrs. Medlock gave me some money from Mr. Craven."
"Did he remember thee that much?" exclaimed Martha.
"Mrs. Medlock said I have 1 shilling a week to spend. She gives me 1 every Saturday. I didn't know what to spend it on."
"My word, that's riches," said Martha.
"Thou can buy anything in the world thou wants. The rent of our cottage is only 3d, and it's like pulling eye teeth to get it. Now I've just thought of something," putting her hands on her hips.
"What?" said Mary eagerly.
"In the shop at Thwaite, they sell packages of flower seeds for 1d each, and our Dickon, he knows which is the prettiest ones, how to make 'em grow. He walks over to Thwaite many a day just for the fun of it. Does thou know how to print letters?"
"I know how to write," Mary answered.
Martha shook her head.
"Ah, Dickon can only read printing. If thou could print, we could write a letter to him, ask him to go and buy the garden tools and the seeds at the same time."
"Oh, you're a good girl," Mary cried. "You are, really. I didn't know you were so nice. I know I can print letters if I try. Let's ask Mrs. Medlock for 1 pen and ink and some paper."
"I got some of my own," said Martha. "I bought them so I could print a bit of a letter to Mother of a Sunday. I'll go get it."
She ran out of the room, and Mary stood by the fire and twisted her thin little hands together with sheer pleasure.
"If I have a spade," she whispered, "I can make the earth nice and soft and dig up weeds. If I have seeds and can make flowers grow, the garden won't be dead at all. It will come alive."
She did not go out again that afternoon, because when Martha returned with her pen and ink and paper, she was obliged to clear the table and carry the plates and dishes downstairs. And when she got into the kitchen, Mrs. Medlock was there and told her to do something. So Mary waited for what seemed to her a long time before she came back. Then it was a serious piece of work to write to Dickon. Mary had been taught very little, because her governess had disliked her too much to stay with her. She could not spell particularly well, but she found that she could print letters when she tried. This was the letter Martha dictated to her. "My dear Dickon, this comes hoping to find you well, as it leaves me at present. Miss Mary has plenty of money. Then will you go to Thwaite and buy her some flower seeds and a set of garden tools to make a flower bed. Pick the prettiest ones, and easy to grow, because she has never done it before, and lived in India, which is different. Give my love to Mother, and every one of you. Miss Mary is going to tell me a lot more, so that on my next day out, you can hear about elephants and camels, and gentlemen going hunting lions and tigers. Your loving sister, Martha Phoebe Sowerby." "We'll put the money in the envelope, and I'll get the butcher boy to take it in his cart. He's a great friend of Dickon's," said Martha.
"How shall I get the things when Dickon buys them?"
"He'll bring them to you himself. He'll like to walk over this way."
"Oh," exclaimed Mary.
"Then I shall see him. I never thought I should see Dickon."
"Does thou want to see him?"
asked Martha suddenly, for Mary had looked so pleased.
"Yes, I do. I never saw a boy foxes and crows loved. I want to see him very much."
Martha gave a little start, as if she remembered something.
"Now to think," she broke out, "to think of me forgetting that there, and I thought I was going to tell you first thing this morning. I asked Mother, and she said she'd ask Mrs. Medlock her own self."
"Do you mean," Mary began,
"what I said Tuesday? Ask her if she might be driven over to our cottage some day and have a bit of Mother's hot oat cake and butter and a glass of milk." It seemed as if all the interesting things were happening in one day.
to think of going over the moor in the daylight and when the sky was blue. To think of going into the cottage which held 12 children. "Does she think Mrs. Medlock would let me go?" she asked quite anxiously. "Aye, she thinks she would. She knows what a tidy woman mother is and how clean she keeps cottage." "If I went, I should see your mother as well as Dickon," said Mary, thinking it over, liking the idea very much. "She doesn't seem to be like the mothers in India." Her work in the garden and the excitement of the afternoon ended by making her feel quiet and thoughtful. Martha stayed with her until tea time, but they sat in comfortable quiet and talked very little. But just before Martha went downstairs for the tea tray, Mary asked a question. "Martha," she said, "has the scullery maid had the toothache again today?" Martha certainly started slightly. "What makes thee ask that?" she said. "Because when I waited so long for you to come back, I opened the door and walked down the corridor to see if you were coming. And I heard that far off crying again, just as we heard it the other night. There isn't a wind today, so you see it couldn't have been the wind." "Eh," said Martha restlessly, "thou mustn't go walking about in corridors and listening. Mr. Craven would be that there angry. There's no knowing what he'd do." "I wasn't listening," said Mary. "I was just waiting for you, and I heard it. That's three times." "My word, there's Mrs. Medlock's bell," said Martha, and she almost ran out of the room. "It's the strangest house anyone ever lived in," said Mary drowsily, as she dropped her head on the cushioned seat of the armchair near her. Fresh air and digging and skipping rope had made her feel so comfortably tired that she fell asleep. The sun shone down for nearly a week on the secret garden. The secret garden was what Mary called it when she was thinking of it. She liked the name, and she liked still more the feeling that when its beautiful old walls shut her in, no one knew where she was. It seemed almost like being shut out of the world in some fairy place. The few books she had read and liked had been fairy story books, and she had read of secret gardens in some of the stories. Sometimes people went to sleep in them for 100 years, which she had thought must be rather stupid. She had no intention of going to sleep, and in fact, she was becoming wider awake every day which passed at Misselthwaite. She was beginning to like to be out of doors. She no longer hated the wind, but enjoyed it. She could run faster and longer, and she could skip up to 100. The bulbs in the secret garden must have been astonished. Such nice, clear places were made round them that they had all the breathing space they wanted. And really, if Mistress Mary had known it, they began to cheer up under the dark earth and work tremendously. The sun could get at them and warm them, and when the rain came down, it could reach them at once. So they began to feel very much alive. Mary was an odd, determined little person, and now she had something interesting to be determined about. She was very much absorbed indeed. She worked and dug and pulled up weeds steadily, only becoming more pleased with her work every hour instead of tiring of it. It seemed to her like a fascinating sort of play. She found many more of the sprouting pale green points than she had ever hoped to find. They seemed to be starting up everywhere, and each day she was sure she found tiny new ones. Some so tiny that they barely peeped above the earth. There were so many that she remembered what Martha had said about the snowdrops by the thousands, and about bulbs spreading and making new ones. These had been left to themselves for 10 years, and perhaps they had spread, like the snowdrops, into thousands. She wondered how long it would be before they showed that they were flowers. Sometimes she stopped digging to look at the garden and try to imagine what it would be like when it was covered with thousands of lovely things in bloom. During that week of sunshine, she became more intimate with Ben Weatherstaff. She surprised him several times by seeming to start up beside him as if she sprang out of the earth. The truth was that she was afraid that he would pick up his tools and go away if he saw her coming. So she always walked toward him as silently as possible. But in fact, he did not object to her as strongly as he had at first. Perhaps he was secretly rather flattered by her evident desire for his elderly company. Then, also, she was more civil than she had been. He did not know that when she first saw him, she spoke to him as she would have spoken to a native, and had not known that a cross, sturdy old Yorkshireman was not accustomed to salaam to his masters and be merely commanded by them to do things. "Art like the robin," he said to her one morning when he lifted his head and saw her standing by him. "I never knows when I shall see thee or which side thou'll come from."
"He's friends with me now," said Mary.
"That's like him," snapped Ben Weatherstaff, making up to the women folk just for vanity and flightiness. "There's nothing he wouldn't do for the sake of showing off and flirting his tail feathers. He's as full of pride as an egg's full of meat."
He very seldom talked much, and sometimes did not even answer Mary's questions except by a grunt. But this morning he said more than usual. He stood up and rested one hobnailed boot on the top of his spade while he looked her over.
"How long's thou been here?" he jerked out.
"I think it's about a month," she answered.
"Thou's beginning to do Misselthwaite credit," he said. "Thou's a bit fatter than thou was, and that's not quite so yellow. Thou's looked quite young plucked crow when thou first come into garden. Thinks I to myself I never set eyes on an uglier, sourer-faced young'un."
Mary was not vain, as she had never thought much of her looks. She was not greatly disturbed. "I know I'm fatter," she said. "My stockings are getting tighter. They used to make wrinkles. There's the robin, Ben Weatherstaff." There indeed was the robin, and she thought he looked nicer than ever. His red waistcoat was as glossy as satin, and he flirted his wings and tail and tilted his head and hopped about with all sorts of lively graces. He seemed determined to make Ben Weatherstaff admire him. But Ben was sarcastic.
"Aye, there thou art," he said. "Thou can put up with me for a bit sometimes when thou's got no one better. Thou's been reddening up thy waistcoat and polishing thy feathers this 2 weeks. I know what thou's up to. Thou's courting some bold young madam somewhere, telling thy lies to her about being the finest cock-robin on Misselmore, and ready to fight all the rest of 'em."
"Oh, look at him," exclaimed Mary. The robin was evidently in a fascinating, bold mood. He hopped closer and closer and looked at Ben Weatherstaff more and more engagingly. He flew on to the nearest currant bush and tilted his head and sang a little song right at him.
"Thou thinks thou'll get me over by doing that," said Ben, wrinkling his face up in such a way that Mary felt sure he was trying not to look pleased. Thou thinks no one can stand out against thee. That's what thou thinks.
The robin spread his wings. Mary could scarcely believe her eyes. He flew right up to the handle of Ben Weatherstaff's spade and alighted on the top of it. Then the old man's face wrinkled itself slowly into a new expression. He stood still, as if he were afraid to breathe, as if he would not have stirred for the world, lest his robin should start away. He spoke quite in a whisper. "Well, I'm danged," he said, as softly as if he were saying something quite different. "Thou does know how to get at a chap, thou does. Thou's fair unearthly, thou's so knowing." And he stood without stirring, almost without drawing his breath, until the robin gave another flirt to his wings and flew away. Then he stood looking at the handle of the spade, as if there might be magic in it. And then he began to dig again, and said nothing for several minutes. But because he kept breaking into a slow grin now and then, Mary was not afraid to talk to him. "Have you a garden of your own?" she asked.
"No, I'm bachelor and lodge with Martin at the gate."
"If you had one," said Mary, "what would you plant?"
"Cabbages, tears, and onions."
"But if you wanted to make a flower garden," persisted Mary, "what would you plant?"
"Bulbs, sweet smelling things, but mostly roses."
Mary's face lighted up. "Do you like roses?" she said. Ben Weatherstaff rooted up a weed and threw it aside before he answered.
"Well, yes, I do. I was learned that by a young lady I was gardener to. She had a lot in a place that she was fond of, and she loved 'em like they was children, or robins. I've seen her bend over and kiss 'em." He dragged out another weed and scowled at it. "That were as much as 10 years ago."
"Where is she now?" asked Mary, much interested.
"Heaven," he answered, and drove his spade deep into the soil, according to what Parson says.
"What happened to the roses?" Mary asked again, more interested than ever.
"They was left to themselves."
Mary was becoming quite excited. "Did they quite die? Do roses quite die when they're left to themselves?" she ventured.
"Well, I'd got to like 'em, and I liked her, and she liked 'em," Ben Weatherstaff admitted reluctantly. "Once or twice a year I'd go and work on 'em a bit, prune 'em and dig about the roots. They run wild, but they was in rich soil, so some of 'em lived."
"When they have no leaves, and look grey and brown and dry, how can you tell whether they're dead or alive?" inquired Mary.
"Wait till spring gets at 'em. Wait till the sun shines on the rain, and the rain falls on the sunshine, and then they'll find out."
"How? How?" cried Mary, forgetting to be careful.
"Look along the twigs and branches, and if thou see a bit of brown lump swelling here and there, watch it after the warm rain, and see what happens."
He stopped suddenly, and looked curiously at her eager face.
"Why dost thou care so much about roses and such all of a sudden?" he demanded. Mistress Mary felt her face grow red. She was almost afraid to answer.
I want to play that I have a garden of my own," she stammered. "There is nothing for me to do. I have nothing and no one."
"Well," said Ben Weatherstaff slowly, as he watched her, "that's true. Thou hasn't."
He said it in such an odd way that Mary wondered if he was actually a little sorry for her. She had never felt sorry for herself. She had only felt tired and cross because she disliked people and things so much. But now, the world seemed to be changing and getting nicer. If no one found out about the secret garden, she should enjoy herself always. She stayed with him for 10 or 15 minutes longer and asked him as many questions as she dared. He answered every one of them in his queer, grunting way, and he did not seem really cross and did not pick up his spade and leave her. He said something about roses just as she was going away, and it reminded her of the ones he had said he had been fond of. "Do you go and see those other roses now?" she asked. "Not been this year. My rheumatics has made me too stiff in joints." He said it in his grumbling voice, and then quite suddenly he seemed to get angry with her, though she did not see why he should. "Now look here," he said sharply. "Does that ask so many questions? Thou'rt the worst wench for asking questions I've ever come across. Get thee gone and play thee. I've done talking for today." And he said it so crossly that she knew there was not the least use in staying another minute. She went skipping, slowly down the outside walk, thinking him over and saying to herself that, queer as it was, here was another person whom she liked in spite of his crossness. She liked old Ben Weatherstaff. Yes, she did like him. She always wanted to try to make him talk to her. Also, she began to believe that he knew everything in the world about flowers. And that is where we close the book tonight on The Secret Garden.